I'm in Aha-Lane here, quite close to the border, on the Cavan-Inniskillen Road, and I'm talking to June Bullock. June, it's lovely to be in your house here and talking to you. I wonder, could you just go back in time and the Bullocks, where did they originally come from? And
Well, the Lord Éireann in the olden days, he brought teachers to the area here, and one of my husband's relations, they were teachers in the little school at Timor, and he and his wife taught there for quite a few years, and then one of the sons, he worked at Kew Gardens, at the Botanical Gardens, and he lived down here at the bridge at the thatched house, the house that's still thatched, and then another of the brothers, he went and worked as a steward at Crum Castle, and then after some years he bought or he built a house over here on this side of the lake.
And so then the next generation after that, that included
Yes, well, my husband's grandmother, and they lived there. The grandmother, she came from Aucrim in County Galway, and then stole my husband's father's. He owned the he kept on with the farm.
Okay, so farmed for
Farmer,
three
oh yes,
generations.
at least, well, three or four,
Four
really. Yeah,
generations, yeah.
that's right.
And then your husband, what was your husband's name?
Story.
Story.
Story, yes, That was a sort of a family name, one of the relations were
And he
Story.
farmed there then.
Yes, he did, yeah. And then he had a disease of his bone marrow, and he died almost 27 years ago.
Oh my goodness, yeah.
Yes, my children were still in their teens, whenever he died.
And you brought up your children here in the house, is it? Or
Well, yes, in the thatched house
in
down at
detached
the yes,
house,
that's
yeah.
right. They were brought up there.
Okay, so tell me what happened in the Troubles in 1969, 1970 when they
Yes,
broke
well,
out.
we got married in 1968, and it's just lovely, peaceful sort of a place. And my brother-in-law had a little filling station just up the road, and people were always coming on their bicycles a lot in those days, and it was very friendly, and we did all our business across the border because the bank was there, and the vet was there, and you had all your groceries there,
In Cavan Town.
No, in Belturbet,
Oh,
in
Belturbet,
Belturbet.
yeah.
And Belturbet was really a thriving little place, and so I got to know the people across there, and the neighbours all knew as well. And of course, when a new bride comes to the place, the neighbours all come to have a look at her and see what she's like and see if she's if she'll fit in. But you get to know all the people like that, and then you were always going in to shop yourself.
Yeah.
And then just 1970 it was, because when I was expecting my first child, the first time I came back from the visit to the doctor, and there were boys had hijacked bus, Ulster bus there, and I didn't know what was going on. We drove on in, you see, and then we discovered they had done this, and then they would put them on fire, and then it sort of from that on. Something like on a Sunday was the worst day, and they would start just taking down the signs for "Welcome to Northern Ireland" and "Welcome to Fermanagh" and different things like this. It sort of started like that, and then it went on, and then there'd be more altogether. I think there was about four buses that had been hijacked and blown, but then
And were
the.
these school children buses or were they?
Oh, no, it was the Ulster bus, It took people from Belturbet into Inniskillen or likely. Now, there was a lovely old man here. He lived about a mile away, Mr. Boyle, and he used to dander down to the bus, and the bus driver would know him and would bring him into the bus, and he would just go across about a mile and a half or so to where his daughter lived, and then he would get off at the lane there, and he would go up, and she would give him his dinner and all, and then there was a bus back in the evening. And then whenever the bridge was blown up in 1972, that finished it. But before that, you see, Mr. Boyle, on one occasion when he was going on the bus, the bus was hijacked just at the bridge, just sort of on the bridge, really. And the Mr. Boyle came in to me. He was just shaking, and he had smell of petrol all over him because, you know, they told him to get out of the bus. And, of course, elderly people, it just takes their time, and he sort of got a bit in their way of the petrol. And he was really very frightened about this, of course. And that changed the whole, as far as his life was concerned, you know. You would be very anxious, you know, about going up on like that. But then a short time after that, the bridge was blown up, and that was the end of it anyway.
I see. And of course, that stopped all the traffic coming this direction, did it?
Or? Well, it stopped it for a while. And then there was still a wee walkway that you could walk over it. But then Cavan County Council decided that the bridge, you see, was built during the famine times. Mm. And it was built on dry land, and the river was diverted. So they said that it was really in their property. So they put up a Bailey Bridge, and then the forces in the north weren't very keen on this at all, and because the terrorists were always using that, you know, when they did something, they always went across the border, and they put up the Bailey Bridge, but they didn't just fill the ends of it, and then the local people from across the border filled up the ends so that the cars could drive again. And then shortly after that, you had the bomb in Belturbet when there was two innocent people killed, so that was another tragedy. And then,
tell me, who blew up the bridge? Was it the dissidents, or was it the army?
Well, some people say it was the army, but it wasn't the dissidents, because they used the bridge all the time, you know. So, and I don't know. They said it wasn't the army, but I don't just know who it was. But I know they were just masked and told us to get out of the house about 20 to 2 in the morning, and Colin was over 2, and Simon was just about 8 months old. So we just had to lift the 2 children and put them in prams and take them. They said that we wouldn't be touching or safe enough. And we went up towards where my brother-in-law had the filling station, and we were just nearly up at that when the bridge went up.
Blew up.
Yeah. But then the second explosion was much more dangerous, because all the metal came, you know, the big iron thing that they had on the bridge, and the big heavy timber came over. And, I mean, it hit the thatch, and it was all scattered over the yard. And if we had been out, they told us again to get out, but we hadn't time to get out because it went up so quickly. And the whole place, you know, closer, you know, than that, and even out onto the field. So if you'd been hit with some of this metal, it wouldn't have been a good idea.
Now tell me, your house, how close is it to the bridge?
Oh, it's just a few hundred yards, you know, because the stone wall that we have, you know, you can see it yourself, it's a couple hundred yards. Okay. You know, yeah.
And was the house damaged? Was it?
Oh, it was. Of course, it was. Yeah, the windows were all broken, of course, and the door was blown in. But one of the big beams on the thatched house, it was damaged as well. But the thatch went up and came down again, so we still had a roof over our heads. And as well as that, we had the old-fashioned shutters on the house. So when we came back, but all around the yard, we had Bangor blue slates on the houses there, and they were all blown up. You know, they were lost. We hadn't any roof at all, but we had a roof on the house. And so whenever we went back, and we just came on up to tell my mother-in-law and my brother-in-law what had happened, because our telephones had been disconnected, you see, some time beforehand. The exchange had been blown up in Derry Lynn, so we didn't have a telephone system at the time. And then we came down. Well, we had the children, so we just came down and we put the children to bed, and we put the shutters over and set the door back on, and we went back to bed. You know, and we put something across the road, but there was very little traffic ever went across, because in those days you had to have a warrant. You know, the way you had to have your something stamped, or you had to say something to. So you always had to have a request if you wanted to go over at night.
Okay, and the checkpoint, where was it?
Well, it was just at the entrance of our farm. Yeah, And
okay.
The one,
and was there a certain sense of security there that you felt that there was presence of?
No, you would have been better without any of them around here. And like we always, you have bad things that happen, but one thing that was funny on the poor man in the Republic side, he was at his counter. All of a sudden, this door, or the wall came in. And he thought he was being attacked, you see, by, I suppose, somebody from the north. I don't know. So he went underneath the bench. And then whenever he looked up, there was a car looking in at him. And it was a drunk driver. And he had just gone and... So he had nothing, you see. So then he came over at that stage. And by that stage, we had a telephone. So he was able to telephone the people. But, you know, there's always something. And then whenever they went back, whenever he went back, the driver had reversed.
Yes.
And then he went up another wee, he went back a wee bit and he went up a wee road and he went into the hedge. So the guards got him all right then. So you never know what's going to happen, but that was it anyway.
Talk to me about the your husband's brother. He was murdered?
No, it was a cousin, a second cousin of his.
Oh, okay.
He and his wife were murdered, yes. That's
and
right.
Where were they living at
they
the
were
time?
Living in their own house. It's just about half a mile from here.
Okay.
Yeah.
And they were bullocks?
Yes, that's right, yeah.
And what, could you tell me what happened exactly?
Well, the people who were murdering, there were three houses they went to that day. And the first house, luckily, the man was draining and he wasn't at home. But you see, this happened about 6 o'clock. And all the farmers around here, more or less, they would have their tea about, you know, that time and listen to the news, because the news wasn't on every hour like it is now. They'd all go in and hear that and then they would go out and milk their cows. But that day... John was working luckily on the farm, and his wife and their son were doing the milking, and the terrorists came, and they were looking for John, and he wasn't in the milking parlour, and so then they went to the house, and John's sister saw them coming, and she had the door locked, and then they put the gun at their heads and said to let him in, and she said no, and they said, well, if you don't, we're going to shoot these people. So they came into the house and they searched the whole place, and they were looking for his gun and all, but they didn't get anything at all. And then it sort of, I think, delayed them a wee bit, and then they went on down to the next place, and they just shot up at this next farmer's farm, and then they went on ahead up to where Tommy and Emily lived, and Emily went to the door and opened the door, and they just shot her, and she was just on her knees whenever the people, you know, when she was found, and they went in and shot Tommy, and there was three different guns used, Tommy, and the door was just riddled in the whole place. It was awful.
Why did they kill?
Well, they were a member of the Ulster Defence Regiment.
Yeah.
Yeah. But Emily wasn't, of course, you know, she was just an ordinary civilian.
So what year did that happen?
That happened in 72.
And were you here at the time?
Oh, yes, I was here at the time, yeah. But then a short time later, you see, they said that they'd be back, you see. And a short time later, John and the neighbour from up here, they were...
what were their surnames?
John Darling.
Oh, Darling,
and
yeah.
Albert Lunny. And that was the post office. And they were standing, you know, sort of out on the road just having a chat. And this car pulled up and the window went down, they started to shoot. So the two farmers had guns, and they shot, one of them shot back. But one of them was... shot in the leg, but luckily enough, you know, we were able to get it just stopped and get him into hospital, because that was often what happened here, you know, in rural areas. Somebody was shot and they just bled to death, you know. Mm-hmm. And you're 20 miles out of Finniskillen, you know, and
yeah.
You know, and it's, if you have somebody that can do something, well, that's great. But often in some of the incidents, I mean, the farmer was out in the field on a tractor, and you know, that's just what happened. But in this incident, it was fine.
And did they? So, who found those two people?
Well, the man in the post office, he heard the shots, and he he immediately thought, you know, because there had been shots, you see, fired. He immediately thought that there was something, you know, and he just went up to where Tommy, it's not very far away, and he just found them.
Okay.
And I had been, that afternoon, I had taken my mother-in-law down to visit an old friend of hers who lives in Derry Lynn. And I, whenever we had that, we were at the filling station, you see, I was collecting it there. And then Tommy's wife, Emily, was there as well. And we told her where we were going. We were going down to see Mrs. McMullen. And she said, oh, I'd love to see her. So we said, well, come on with us, you know. So Emily just left her bicycle there and she came with us. And we went down and she had a bunch of sweet pea, and she gave them to Mrs. McMullen. Mrs. McMullen was glad to see her, you know, just for a few minutes, and then we came back, and we were standing outside the filling station just when we came back, and the car came down, and very, very slowly, and there was a whole lot of men in it, and they looked and looked. They were, you know, you could have nearly walked as quickly as we were, and Emily said, oh, well, those fellas will know us the next time they see us. And that was after about 4 o'clock or so. And at 6 o'clock, she was dead.
And they killed her because
she recognised
who they were?
Well, oh, no, no. Well, I wouldn't know that she'd recognise them, but it's because her husband was there and she wasn't trying. She was just put, you know, was trying not to let them in, if you know what I mean, you know?
That's right. And oh yes, of course. And yeah. So, but you think those were the...
Oh, those were definitely the ones because they were, yeah, because, you know... You see, the whenever you haven't much, security out here, you know, and these people, and they have someone who knows where everybody lives, and you know, they would.
So it's local knowledge.
Yes, local knowledge. Yes, and I mean, not just in the north; it was in the Republic side.
But some people would say that might have been a grudge, or you know, why would you want to do something like that?
Well, it was just anything, you know, anything to do with the security forces. You were a target.
Yeah. But you're...
And you see, you're very vulnerable here, and especially farmers, because you have a certain routine that you have to maintain, you know, and they would know that. And also they would know, you know, if anyone had worked, you know, at the school or anything, they knew exactly the schoolmaster's routine as well.
Okay. And you're right living... proximity to all these places.
Yes, that's right.
All these murders.
Yes,
were carried
that's right.
Out.
That's right. Yeah.
Does that make you? Were you living in fear yourself in those years?
You see, I would have left in a minute, but my husband said, "If you start running, where are you going to end up?" And he said, "So then that was just the end of it. We just went on." But I mean, it was. Like I remember one time, I don't know whether it was the there was something that blew up I think it was probably the customs post, and it was early in the morning, and I was going in. It was just a short time before my son was born, and I was going in to see the obstetrician, and the first thing I knew was the window came in the bathroom, and they had blown up the customs post. You see, so when I went in then to Inniskill, and Dr. Purden said to me, "Well, what happened to you?" He says, "Your blood pressure's so high you couldn't even record it." And I told him what it was. And then whenever I came home, my husband and I came home, the police were at the filling station and told us that the road was closed. And I said, well, we lived here, we're going on. And he said, well, there are people are firing at us, you know. So, you see, whenever you come down, you'll be able to see that there's a hill above, so that people have always got, you know, they're looking down at you all the time. So these were the sort of things that went on all the time. But then, whenever the customs post was blown up, they used to bring out caravans.
Yeah.
And then they might last for a week, mightn't even last for that length of time, till they were put, you know, there was a fire and thing, and they would blow up. And the worst thing is you'd be in bed and the next thing you hear this big bang, but it was the cylinder, you know, it was gone, you know. So that was quite often it happened as well.
My goodness. And so when the bridge was blown at that stage,
that was right. But still in all, even after two explosions, there was still a narrow pathway that you could walk across.
Yeah.
You see, and you know, we still kept in touch with people just going across there. But then then they used it, the terrace again. I don't know whether it was when they blew up. You see, Mr. McMullen had a shop up here as well, and his shop was blown up. And I don't know whether it was that, but they came again in their car, and they left the engine running, and they ran over the bridge there. So after that, then we had the third explosion at the bridge, and it was, I think, on a Sunday night or a Saturday night, because I got a knock at the door, and this man, masked man with a gun, told us that they were going to, it was going to be an explosion, and just to stay in out of the way. So whenever that happened, then you're free. You know, it wasn't until the third bridge that you knew that the people couldn't go any farther. They couldn't escape over to across to the public after that.
Okay, and that person who came to the door and said, you know,
yeah,
be careful. He was masked.
He was masked.
But
yeah,
you're not sure who they might have been.
Yeah, well, he was masked anyway, so you don't ask questions about them.
Imagine.
No. I used to laugh at people saying, whenever the bridge was blown up and all, did you open your windows and do all that? I says, for goodness sake, you have to get the two children, babies out. And you go on and you're not worried about anything. So after that, I was never too fussy about my house, you know, because everything was just, you just said, well, you know, if you had any notion about having a very fancy house, you weren't going to have it. And the greenhouse, it was funny when I got married, you know, the money I got, I put it into a greenhouse, and two pigs from a neighbour, Michael Kernan, I got two pigs, and we got the... Oh, and a sewing machine, and then I got a goose and a gander. So I was saying the young women nowadays just wouldn't have something like that, but that's what I had. They were sort of practical things, you know. And then we just had, after the first explosion, you know, we had a few months, we fixed up the greenhouse again, put the glass in again, and it went away after that. So I said, oh, bother you. Yeah. But anyway...
Destroyed your glasshouse.
Yeah. Oh, that was it. Plastic on the third time, and that was it anyway. But that was the way it went.
What a story! I mean, it's incredible when I listen to you, and you know, it was like living in the middle of a war zone. You know, yeah. It was fighting on both
That's
sides.
Right. And there was a lovely article in the Irish Times in 1972. I don't know. They say there was one of the relations of the Bullocks. He was a writer, Sean Bullock. He wrote about 20 something books, you see, and he had Benedict Kiley. You know, his great Tyrone accent. You know, he wrote a lovely article because he had been through the bridge, you know, and up there just a short time before that. And he wrote a lovely article. It was about he did a series of articles about Sean Bullock. You know, five or six articles, and I think it was, he called them, what did he call them, the Orange Lily in the Green Field, something like that. But they're very good. I have an article somewhere. They're very, very good, yeah. You know. And he talked about how lovely it was, and you know, the trees, and he'd asked my brother-in-law, was there any trouble? And the brother-in-law said, oh, there's no trouble here. You know, there's only trouble up in the north, you know. So that was just whenever things were nice and calm. But yeah, that's the way it changed.
Just explain to me the relationship between your late husband and the Bullocks.
Yeah, he was a second cousin. You know,
so, yes.
Yeah, that was
so
the,
they
the
had the same cousin. Grandfather.
Yes, that was right. That was right.
And what was his name?
Now, I think he was Thomas now. I think he was Thomas,
and
yeah.
Thomas owned all the land here, and he divided it up. Is that
No, he didn't. Or, you know, whenever, was it in the 1900s, you know, whenever the people got their land, you see, we were the poorer relations, you know. And the you know, husband people were the poorer relations. And the people at Killinick were a bit more upmarket.
Of the Bullock family.
Yes, that's right.
Collection of people.
And, and he had the land there. But you see, it wasn't very, you know...
Did you know them very well? I know you spoke about
Tommy and Emily.
Tommy. You spoke about Emily.
Yes, what about Tommy? Oh, well, you see, my husband had known him, but Tommy was a very shy man, and so was his brother. And after a wee while, you know, his brother lived over in Maguire's Bridge, where Tommy came from, you see. And then, you see, there was an uncle who lived up there, a bachelor, you see, at Killinick. And whenever he died, Tommy acquired the farm. And then he moved in there. But everybody knew Tommy all right, you know, but he was still a very quiet man, and his brother was very quiet and shy.
So he did nothing out of the way.
No, not at all. He wasn't. He was mad. When he came, first of all, he had a motor bicycle with a sidecar, you know, on there, and he went about in that and he fished. He was harmless. He wasn't aggressive in any way at all. No. And Emily was, she was a lovely, warm person, you know, she was really great.
And you were with her?
That afternoon. Just, you know, and we'd gone down to Derry Lane and back again, and she'd been telling me about a lovely house. If you go on down past where she lived, you go on ahead down and they had a schoolhouse, and then on one side, if you go to the left, you go to the schoolhouse where the children used to go from the estate and from here as well. And then you went to the right, and there was this other lovely house that was built for, they called it the cottage, but it was a beautiful big house, and where Lord Erne had built it for the curate. And then when, of course, you didn't have a curate there anymore, it was rented out, and there was a family from Dublin who used to come up there, you know. I don't know whether he worked at Trinity, but I know he had read, he was able to acquire the Bullock books, and he read them, you know. We've all got some of their books nowadays, you know, with the Bullock books. But it was very interesting, and he had spent a lot of money doing the place up, and they used to come there all the time, you know, and the children had their bicycles and all that, and the IRA, they put it on fire. They came over in their boat, and it was just, and Emily was telling me about this. She says, I'll have to take you down to let you see it. She says, all that was left in the house, she says, we could just have put it in a wheelbarrow and brought it home. There was such a small amount of stuff left, you know. Yeah. Their bicycles, everything was just burnt.
Imagine.
Yeah.
And why would they burn that house down?
That was just another, I don't even try to think what they're doing, but it's just the way. It belonged to Lord Eyre in the house, you know.
And so, to try and make sense of it all, I suppose, is not easy. But were you, do you know, you have, the place is lovely, because I visited it yesterday evening, and I walked around the outhouses and the farmhouse, and the lovely thatch that you've really kept.
Yes, that's right.
And the house dates back to an early time.
Yes, that's right. The archaeologist, Mr. Oren, he used to be, you know, with the environmental, you know, looked after the old buildings and all. And he said it was a very big house, large house, you know, and it had a high roof as well, you know. And then whenever we were fixing it up, there's a mud wall in it too, you know, and we had to get a new upstairs in before Simon and Jennifer got married. And he said it was somebody very important that lived in it. But do you know Mr. Morrissey? Have you met him?
Yeah, George.
Well, George Morrissey. Well, he would tell you about who lived in it. There were Roman Catholic bishop or somebody. I have it written down somewhere.
And of course, poor George's brother, who was a guard, he was killed.
That was right. You see, so many people have been touched, and from both sides of the community. Yeah. Yeah. And I think, you know, when we were doing the quilt, you saw the quilt.
Yeah, we were doing that there.
And I mean, it just even makes you think about, you know, why people sort of hate America and different places that bomb the places and kill the children and family. You know, things get into, you know, you couldn't but be thinking about that, you know, whenever, especially the quilt that we were doing recently about the children who were,
That kind of therapy, if you like, in doing that. Does that help you?
Yes. Well, you see, you always have to think that there's, you know, two sides to every thing.
And when I'm talking to you and interviewing you about this, do you feel telling the story in itself is a good it's good.
We didn't really bother, but you see, we had so many incidents here, and then whenever they built whenever they worked on the canal, you know, there was always a great interest in it, you know, and people were always coming and asking you, but you weren't going to go up to somewhere and start talking about it, if you know what I mean.
I know.
You weren't going to say anything. If somebody asked you, you would answer them and tell them what happened, you know, but you weren't going to go around saying about all the things that happened to me because...
Oh, I know, yeah, you know, but is it a form of therapy in a way, you know, just to get, you know, that... It's part of history, or maybe, hopefully, it's part of history.
Well, you see, I was sort of brought up. My grandfather was kidnapped in 1922. We lived along the border of Dochnacloy, and there was, I think, a group of men were going across the border, and they were armed, from what I gather. And they said they were going to play a football match, but I think they were trying to. There was somebody had been up for some thing or other. I don't know what it was, but they were going to try and get this man, you know, free him, you know. And anyway, so then all this group of men that were going were all, you know, arrested at Dochnacloy. And then the same number of men were kidnapped round the border at Dochnacloy, especially larger farmers, you know. Yeah. And they were taken. And my grandfather, he had only bought the farm. He came from County Down, and he had bought the farm, earlier, I suppose, sometime before the war, the 1418 war. And he was very hands-on, of course, and he was down at the pit where the potatoes were, and he had taken off his jacket, and he was with some of them, and they came and they took him. And my grandmother, she had two children, and she was expecting her third baby at this time. And they took him. And then the next door neighbour was, he was an ex-army man, you know. I'll just think of his name in a minute.
What was your grandfather's name?
He was Joseph McClemens.
Okay.
Joseph McClemens, you see. And they were, Major Mutry was the man. He had a big estate quite close to my grandfather. And they put him, whenever they got them all round up, they put them in this cattle lorry. And they were taking them down, and they went down to Trim. But Major Mutry, he wouldn't go into the back of the cattle lorry with the other men. But he went into the front seat. Well, when they were going down through some town, and there's a big fair, and then all the people down there heard, oh, it was these fellas from the north that were taken. So they came, and they had their sticks and all, and they were poking at the so the men in the cattle lorry were okay because they could keep out of the way of the sticks. But Major Mutry, he had a worse time because I don't know whether they spat on him, but I think he had a rougher time in the front with the other people, you know. But anyway, but my grandfather...
And they were taken as hostages,
were Yes, they were taken as hostages, yeah. And then my grandfather was the last one released, and it was Edward Carson, you know...
at that time.
Yes, he organised that naturally. But he had, you see, he didn't have a jacket with him because he was in a shirt, and he got pneumonia. And that's why he was the last one that was released, because he was very ill.
Yeah.
And then after that, you see, whenever my grandfather came back up to home, his brother came down from County Down, from Banbridge, and he stayed with him.
Yeah.
And then the IRA came back again, and they set us, you know, the house that he lived in, it was... there was a man had built a castle beside it, you see, and the house that my grandfather lived in was this for the stable men, you know. It was big, long, and there was a courtyard around it, you see, and it was lovely stonework. He was one of these famous architects who he did. But of course, the man ran out of money, the man who had started, so then my grandfather bought the farm, you see.
Oh, yes.
You see, and that was it anyway. And that was it. But he came back, and then the IRA came back and set his things on fire, say. But and then my brother-in-law or his...
You put your hay on fire.
They put things on fire then. But they were firing at them. But my grandfather, you see, it was an L-shaped house.
Yeah.
So my grandfather with his gun was at one thing, and then the other brother was at the other thing. So they started firing away. So that, you know, it was a great thing, you know, they weren't going to get them, if you know what I mean, very, very easily. So, but my grandfather never spoke about it. He never spoke it. And the only thing we'd ever hear was from the brother who came to stay. He never mentioned it. But he was always anxious about if he was sitting in the hall and if somebody came, he'd say, who's there? Who's there? You know.
Yeah.
And the only time that he ever got concerned was when he was living with my father and mother his latter years, and somebody came in and it reminded him of one of these fellows. And he said, oh, get him out, get him out. He was really upset about this, you know. And it was the only time. But, I mean, we always had the people from across the border, you know. It was how I got to know it. Whenever we were growing up, there was about 26 or 7 acres of orchard. So we used to get the people from across, you know, the river. They just had to go over a wee foot, just down. We could walk over the Blackwater River. And, you know, you had maybe about a dozen people the first wee while when you were doing the Grenadier apples. And then there'd be more and more come until you'd have maybe up to 80.
Yeah.
And so we used to have to go and help to feed them. Because they came at 8 o'clock and then at 12 o'clock on the dot they were in waiting for them. You know, the food was on the table for them, you know. And then you went out again with tea at 3 o'clock. So we sort of got to know everybody from across the way. And we knew no difference. You know, that we were always, you know, like that. And then the priest from Auchincloss, he used to go out because my grandfather had horses and the priest loved horses. And he was often there too. So we never passed a bit of remark about that. Yeah. And even the first time I ever went over to the west of Ireland, it was my grandfather and this other man that used to, you know, when they were buying sheep and all, he would do there. So we went over to when I went to Westford and Clifton and all around there. It was always with these.
I imagine, yeah. And do you think you were brought up in...
Oh, I was brought up with... It didn't make a bit of odds, you know. It didn't make a bit of odds. There was no mention of anything, you know. And that was just the way we were brought up. And the first big gathering I was ever at was in Auchincloss, and it was a Republican one. And I must have been about 47, 48 around that time, because my mother had had a gastrectomy and she had to have another operation, you see. And we had a lovely wee girl, Jane Trainer, and she was a lovely wee girl, and she looked after us. And there was I don't know what it was for, but it happened in Auchincloss anyway. And Jane said she'd bring us, my sister and myself, in. And so we went in, and there's a big gathering. And they had a tricolour up on this shed. And the police sergeant came down and said they had to take it down. And of course, that raised the room. And I don't know I can't remember whether the flag came down or not. But anyway, then the sergeant, he could see the people were aggravated. And he went up the stairs to the vet's house and asked to come in there. And the next thing was, the stones started coming through. Well, all we could hear was this growling, you know, and we could see the stones coming and throwing them, and everybody shouting, you know, and we were. And what I remember most was people saying, oh, get the children out of it, get the children out of it, get the children out of it. So we went on ahead down the side, but the sergeant said to Mr. Conde, let me out the back. And Mr. Conde says, no, you come in the front door, you'll go out the front door. And so the sergeant had to go out and he got up the, you know, I could never, so that was the first gathering, a big gathering I was ever at. So that must have been about 48 or so, round about that age, you know.
Imagine then, and where was it?
This was Knocknacloy.
That's your own?
My own home, yes, because we had no car or anything. You walked in or you had a bicycle, but in those days we walked in, you know,
You were a teenager then, were you?
Not at all, I was only 8.
Oh, you were only 8.
I was only 8 and 9, you see. And then the people kept saying, well, get the children away, get the children out. So that was my first experience. Experience of any large gathering, shall we say.
Oh, my goodness, yeah. And so in all that length of time, what's normal? Do you feel...
I don't bat a bit of mind. I just enjoy every day and that is it.
And does your religion count? I mean, were you brought up in Church of Ireland?
Yes. My mother, you see, was a Seventh-day Adventist. And you see, because my grandfather was a Seventh-day Adventist. And whenever he bought the farm at Auchincloss, his father said to him, now, be sure and pay your deposit because somebody might
you know, object to you not being the right religion. So he had paid the deposit, and then the people, then it, they were trying to get it off him because he wasn't the right religion. And you see, he kept it, he kept Saturday more like the Jewish people, you know, he kept Saturday, and then all the people Sunday. So his, the people that worked with him on the farm, they had Saturday and Sunday off. And then he got them Wellingtons, and they said, he'll never make it, you know, he'll never make it, you know, not having anybody working. But he did make it all right anyway. But that was it anyway.
Yeah, yeah. And so the...
So then my mother, she was she was confirmed in into the Church of Ireland.
Yeah.
So we went there. But then when I went to, when I went to nursing, you see... I went to the Baptist church. I went to different churches because you had to sort of just it didn't depend.
Suppose when so much trouble is around you,
that's
too,
right.
You
that's
have
right.
to. Did you find that you could get solace in a church or?
It was lovely too. Whenever I was working in teaching hospital in Belfast at the Royal, and it was lovely there because you have people from all nationalities there, and you're working with them. And you know, I remember we had a big, lovely, big coloured man from the Sudan, and we asked him. He was asked to be Santa Claus, you see, at Christmas time. And he was so chuffed about this, you know, it wasn't his religion, but you know the way it was, you know.
Yeah.
And everybody, and then this lovely boy from Thailand, you know, you just got to know everybody. And as well as that, when you got to know them, you also got to know about, you know, whenever Moat was the lovely wee surgeon from Thailand, and we got to know his wife, and he would have parties and things like that. You'd always be going, and then he would tell you about, you know, what you did in his religion, about the Buddhist, and you learned about everything. You learned everybody's religion, so you were really open to everything.
Yeah.
You weren't going to say that yours was the only religion. You never said that.
June, it's lovely talking to you, and I appreciate you telling me your story. So, June Bullock, thank you very much. Thank you.
Not at all.